This is The Guardian.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point on the price-performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed, and Haiku is the fastest and lowest cost model in the market, perfectly designed for high volume, high speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to keep them at the frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Straightforward wins at the top of the Premier League as Arsenal go top, however briefly. And is that a statement performance from Manchester City? Is this the moment where they just decide to win all the rest of the football matches? Phil Foden's hat-trick, where does his left foot rank in world football? Left feet right now, a supreme performance from a player who might end up winning 100 Premier Leagues before he's 30. Arsenal make a lot of changes, but find it pretty easy against a depleted Luton Town. Nice to see Emile Smith-Rowe and Reece Nelson, while Gabriel and Saliba meant Luton barely got a sniff. We'll take a look at the run-ins for the top three, and then there's Brentford 0, Brighton 0. Wish us luck with that one. We'll explain why the Swedish league is or isn't interesting. We'll confirm how sleepy Barry looked in yesterday's selfie. Answer your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jonathan Faduba, welcome.
Good morning, Max.
Good morning, Jonathan. Hello, Robin Cowan.
Good morning, Max.
And hello, Barry Glendenning.
Hello. Very worried about this selfie revelation.
No, you needn't be too worried, okay. But we'll get to it. Alex says, not a question, just to say what a great lineup. Can't wait. So it's up to you three not to ruin it then with this vote of confidence from Alex. Let's start at the Etihad, shall we? Man City 4, Aston Villa 1. I mean, the way Phil Foden moves, Robin, the way he strikes a ball, it's also just effortlessly natural, isn't it?
Yeah. It's infuriating. He's so talented. Just the grace, the poise, and the end product. I think that's the big thing. I think my favourite goal was the first one was the wall, clearly parting for him, so that shouldn't have gone in. But the second one, he doesn't even look, does he? He just knows where the goal is, swipes at it off the post. No, he's been superb this season. It's his best return of goals. I really, really enjoyed that Haaland was dropped and thinking that Roy Keane is now actually in Pep Guardiola's head.
Yeah, well, we get on to Haaland, but I mean, that's an interesting point that he wasn't there and De Bruyne wasn't there, Jonathan. And you sort of wonder, is Phil Foden better when they're not there? Or do we just notice him more? Or do you think he sort of goes, actually, I've got to seize the moment now, these other big guns. I mean, they're all big guns around him. But I just wonder if he's, you know, that helps him. He has more space. He's more central to everything.
I think the fact that obviously De Bruyne and Foden, they occupy similar positions, or they like to anyway. Foden obviously has gone on record and prefers to play down the middle as a 10, more centrally, and he's kind of better. He's a better player there, really, to be honest. So I think that helps. I think partly it's the fact that he's maturing as well. He's really coming into his own now, and there's always been that, you know, in the early part of his career, there was that dynamic where Pep was maybe hesitant to play him in his position or play him in games, and he's now starting to take control of the team, really, in a way. And I mean, I'm probably De Bruyne's biggest fan, or one of the biggest fans, but I wonder if this is like a turning point from the transition from De Bruyne to Foden as sort of the main creator in the City team, because De Bruyne is starting to pick up those injuries, and, you know, he's been an amazing player, but I wonder if he's quite as reliable just with age and injuries as he has been in previous seasons, which would be really sad because I love him. But Foden, I think he's outstanding. I think it's partly maturity. The third goal, it reminded me of, in a weird way, the Wayne Rooney goal against Newcastle, where he sort of gets fouled. He's like, it's a free kick. And then he just gets up and bangs one into the net, like from 20 yards or so. And yeah, it's less maybe sort of animalistic than Rooney, but it was more aesthetic. But it kind of did remind me of that goal. But he's just like such a class player, and a joy to watch, really.
Does this form, Barry, send shivers up your spine ahead of the Euros, or just make it all the sweeter when we've got a player of this quality when we go out to Spain on penalties?
I suppose it's just raises questions of where do you play him in the England team? I mean, there is a chance Gareth Southgate won't start him, which I think would be insanity, because he's just such a good player. He's like a bloke out there playing with his mates on the street, just having a kick around, you know? But he's so good. I think I'd have him. He hasn't performed brilliantly for England, and people say because it's not in his best position, or we raised the point last week, you know, is it because he's not playing with players who are as good as the ones he plays with City? But then when he plays for City and De Bruyne, who is arguably City's best creative player, doesn't play, Foden gets his chance to shine and invariably takes it. So I think if I was Gareth Southgate, I'd have him as a number 10 and play Jude Bellingham further back with right alongside Rice. But other opinions are available. But just a virtuoso performance last night. And I mean, this was a tricky game for City. Well, it could have been, because Villa beat them last time at Villa Park. It was only 1-0, but Villa really dominated that game and the scoreline didn't do them justice. So it was quite, I suppose, brave of Guardiola to leave Kevin De Bruyne and Haaland out. But yeah, they had won this game with a minimum of fuss.
I mean, other opinions are available on where Foden should play for England. I feel like we've got quite a few months to have that conversation. Ali McCoy said, look, you know, England just need Foden and 10 other players, any old 10. Get the fence posts of West Ham. Was it?
Is Joel Ward available? Is he in there?
Yeah. I think he probably is. Yeah. I mean, at the risk of hyperbole, Robin, which we try to avoid, you know, is Phil Foden's left foot the best left foot in world football? I was thinking about, I mean, Messi is still playing, right? So, you know, and Salah has quite a good left foot, but there aren't that many, I don't think.
No, I think it's more aesthetically pleasing being left-footed, and I would say that because I am left-footed as well.
Right, of course.
I think the true test is we need to, who can open a can with their left foot. That's okay, that's true. How we will settle this. I'm not sure how we can organise it, but the way he manipulates it, the ball. I remember, I mean, David Silva was extremely left-footed, wasn't he? I can't remember. When he touched the ball with his right, it was a real like, whoa. I think Phil Foden's a bit more, you know, ambipedal, if that's the word. But yeah, I mean, superb. I think Martin Odegaard also, the sort of that, the left foot. But yeah, we need the can opening competition, in my opinion.
Right. So the can opening thing is trickier now that, I mean, they're not automated. We were talking about AI before this, Jonathan. I mean, soon they'll just open themselves the cans. But, you know, was the opening a can before the ring pull came in? Even still, would be tricky to do with your left foot. I mean, have you got any others?
I thought you meant opening a can using a can opener. Because I'm left-footed and there's no way I could even begin to attempt that.
That is the... that's the phrase, isn't it? You know, I mean, back to the actual footballing question, Jonathan. Like, who, is there anyone we're missing? I mean, it is so... I think aesthetically, it's nicer than Salah's, I think.
Andy Hinchcliffe.
Yeah, Andy Hinchcliffe, Julian Dix, fine. I'm happy with those. Chris Waddle. But what, anyone from the modern times, Jonathan?
Well, Haaland's left-footed, isn't he? And I suppose we haven't mentioned him. I think he's left-footed, right?
Yeah, so. That's not a can opener, though, is it? That is just a can exploder type thing.
Chopped tomatoes everywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think Foden's definitely got an argument. I mean, there is a, like you just said, there is a guy called Lionel Messi who hasn't retired yet. And until that day, I think he probably wins it. But, you know, in the Premier League at the moment, I think it's just, as Robin mentioned, that aesthetic side of Foden, like the touch and the ability, the grace he plays with on that left foot. And I love the way he sort of seems to sort of push the ball as if it's like on a carpet, you know, like he has this sort of trick of his where he's able to sort of push the ball and then go around someone or shift it and shoot. So I am struggling to think of someone with a better left foot, but I'm probably missing a lot of people.
So he has like an ice hockey puck, isn't it? Some sort of the way he sort of pushes it. Yeah, you're right. He's already got 5 Premier League titles at 23, you know, and lots of other, you know, Champions League and FA Cup, whatever. He could end up needing an enormous table when someone asked him to lay his medals on the table when he's in that, when he's a pundit and someone says, come on, get your medals out, Phil. Do any other City players deserve a mention, Barry, in this? Rodri getting his 8th of the season? Doku's fun?
Rodri, yeah, Rodri's just top drawer. And Phil Foden was singing his praises after the game, saying there's nothing he can't do. And, yeah, I suppose a lot of his good work goes unseen. And I think we had the discussion recently, you know, what is it that makes him so good? And no one could quite put their finger on it. But he can just do things other players can't. And he's sensational. Bernardo Silva, look, City don't have any bad players, you know. It's just, they don't. Jack Grealish, he played last night, he played well. Doku was good. They're all, you know, it's not fair, really.
No, they also had a reserve keeper called True Grant. Sort of sounds like the most honest Hugh Grant you could meet, doesn't it? And that's, as Barry mentioned, Robin, like, this was a potential banana seat. Like, Villa did really beat them well, but they were missing Martinez, McGinn and Watkins, right? And, you know, once that happens against this kind of side, then it's going to be a struggle. And they actually played okay that first half. You know, they played okay.
No, they did. And I think it possibly would have been slightly different had they gone in at half-time 1-1, because that was just a real blow to them. No, I think, you know, they're still definitely, you know, in the box seat for the top four if they keep going. This was always going to be a tricky game, especially without Ollie Watkins. So it can happen against Man City, especially away from home. You know, they're pretty imperious at the Etihad at the best of times. So I think, you know, I did really like their goal, though. A perfectly executed 1-2 still really works, doesn't it, John Duran?
Yes.
Yeah, love that.
And some really impressive not interfering with play.
Oh, yeah, love that. Like, the awareness, because I definitely would have touched it.
That was some top draw not interfering. I suppose, like, in the race for... The good thing for Villa, Jonathan, is they've got this one out of the way, because, like, Villa and Spurs both have to play, until yesterday, City, Liverpool and Arsenal, right? And I guess fifth will probably get Champions League. And barring something extraordinary from Manchester United, those two will make it, you imagine.
Yeah, I think I don't think Manchester United are in it, really, with the run of games they've got. Of course, could be proven wrong if they get a result against Chelsea. But of course, they've got Liverpool as well this weekend, so they've got a tough run of fixtures. Villa have kind of wobbled slightly in recent weeks, but they've had quite a lot of injuries. You know, they had some fringe players in this side last night. I thought Duran looked okay. Seemed to get a head injury every sort of 10 minutes. But besides that, he was, you know, he looked solid and sort of led the line quite well, I thought, in Watkins' absence. But I think Villa's... I think they will get there, but they just need to maybe up that form a little bit, slightly. But, you know, they're playing the Man City team, who they did actually have some good chances on the break. And I still think with Man City, they, in transition phases, they do play quite a high-risk game. There was quite a few times where Villa broke on them and had maybe a 3v2 or a 4v3 and that kind of thing, but just didn't capitalise on it, and that was a downfall really in the end.
Yeah, because Villa did have quite a few chances when it was still 2-1, and obviously that free kick today, and that was criminal. Zaniola and Ezra Konsa just turned their backs to the ball. I would say Unai Emery was furious.
Yeah, I mean, turning your back is the biggest crime a footballer can commit, isn't it? You know, whatever you do, you don't turn your back. Let it hit you flush in the face. Just take it like a man. Joey says, was Barry aware of who Callum Chambers was playing for? I presumed he was in the A-League by now. Yes. Did Callum Chambers turn up? What game was that in? Was that in this game?
Yeah.
He plays for Villa.
He's a Villa player.
Yeah, but you knew that?
I knew he was at Villa, yeah. I think I just presumed he was injured or something. Isn't he always injured?
Quite often. Mm. He did kick someone over. Did he kick Foden up? There was like a really good, this is just somebody kicking someone over, because that's all they can do. It was Jack Grealish he kicked over. Yeah, that's right, isn't it? Sam Lee in The Athletic, a good writer on Man City, said, look, the 1894 groups, a City supporters group, they had that banner up last week about season ticket prices. They didn't have a display at the Etihad last night after members had accreditations removed following Sunday's record profits, record prices protest banner. Accreditations not yet returned. Without them, the group cannot set up the displays pre-match. Oh, look, we've seen this, Jonathan, haven't we, with season ticket prices. We've seen it at Fulham and at Spurs as well. At City, they're up by an average of 5% despite these record profits, just doesn't feel quite right. But it does seem, it seems wrong, Jonathan.
Yeah, I mean, I think it seems wrong for a lot of teams. There's the issues at Spurs at the moment as well. There's that, you know, the fans aren't too happy with the situation there and the ticket prices and concessions. And I think that is an ongoing debate. I suppose if you look at the sad, cold, hard economic realities of it, match day income is not as significant to Premier League clubs as it is clubs low down the pyramid. You know, broadcast income and commercial income is like the main drivers really of income in the Premier League these days. And so from that perspective, fans have slightly less of a voice when it comes to decision makers at the big clubs because they don't contribute as much revenue, I guess, in a way. And that is a sad thing. And that's a debate that probably needs to happen at some point in terms of how that's managed, because no one wants to see a spectacle with empty, you know, no one in the stadiums. But at the same time, they're not the economic drivers of clubs at the moment. It's more the TV money and the commercial deals. So it is an issue, and I guess I don't know the full context of the City situation, so it's hard to comment on that individually. But I guess there is this kind of underlying discontent with some fans at a lot of the clubs in the top league at the moment in the Premier League.
Yeah, but I mean, I suppose if they're not the economic driver, Barry, then you don't need to raise the prices, point, right? Yeah. Because the prices don't matter as much.
Just before I come back to that, I should say that according to Sam Lee's Twitter, City did tell him that the 1894 group didn't apply for accreditation for the Villa game, but would have been given it if they had applied. That's something the 1894's own account denied. But back to your question, it is just gouging, isn't it? I've seen it recently firsthand at the Cheltenham Festival. Everything's too dear. And the one thing that used to guarantee the good crowds in at Cheltenham was the competitiveness of the racing. But now there's too much racing. So trainers are picking and choosing which races to put their horses in so they can avoid other horses. So even the racing now isn't as good. And that really affected Cheltenham this year. It only sold out one day out of the four. And the other three crowds were way, way down, like worryingly down. Cheltenham always attracts big crowds from Ireland. A lot of them didn't travel because people are skint. People can't afford it. The difference between horse racing and football is fans love their football clubs, but their football clubs don't love them back. And, you know, if fans are priced out of going to games, there are other people there to take their place. There are waiting lists. There are tourists who would like to go and watch Phil Foden play or Kevin De Bruyne play. Or I think the only Premier League club, certainly London, that there are always tickets available is Fulham, and they're one of the most expensive games to go to, but they usually sell out because people are in London, they want to go and see a game, they don't really care who they go to see, so you know you can get into Fulham, so yeah, we'll go there. And Manchester City are owned by an autocratic state, and autocratic states do not like protest. So that's why the banner was taken down, I reckon. It was initially explained that it was taken down because the banner was hanging over an advertising hoarding, but later clarified as not having been checked to have a fire safety certificate. So, oh, make of that what you will. They will gouge every penny they can out of fans because they don't, as I said, the fans love them, they don't love the fans, they're just customers. Mm.
Bit like us and the listeners. They love us, but we don't give a shit.
Well, I love the listeners. Most of them.
No, of course. Actually, on those advertising boards at City, those double height ones, they're terrible, aren't they? Like, sort of a giant bottle of Asahi that's bigger than Erling Haaland. I can't really see them, but you know. Anyway, perhaps that's just my issue. Anyway, of course, I love you all very much. And we'll be back in a second to talk about Arsenal Luton.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. The Emirates Arsenal 2, Luton 0. I mean, pretty straightforward, Robin. Puts them top for now. Obviously, Liverpool play Sheffield United tonight. And I guess Luton have proved tricky for lots of other sides. And they played okay. And even with lots of rotation, Arsenal were totally fine.
Yeah, this is the perfect night. As you said, lots of rotation. Saka, rested, but also perhaps slightly injured. Rice on the bench. Very easy. Didn't really have to get out of second gear. Top of the league. Really good goal difference. And yet they still might just finish third. It's, that just might happen. I mean, Luton didn't really lay a glove on them. I think Rob Edwards said after the game, Arsenal just don't give up any chances. They have the best defence in the league. As I say, they're in a really good spot, but it's just, it's going to be tough, isn't it? It's going to be very, very tough. If Liverpool win all their games, then they've won the league.
What did you make of this one, Jonathan?
I thought that Emile Smith Rowe had quite a good game. Obviously, Arsenal played a fringe side. Not fringe side, but, rested a lot of people and Saka wasn't there, as mentioned, Rice. But I thought Smith Rowe kind of showed glimpses of, remember that original song, the Saka and Emile Smith Rowe song that Arsenal fans enjoyed a few years back when that sort of the youth started to emerge and the feel-good factor came back to the club. And Smith Rowe was part of that. And there's the song, but he's not really been playing as much. So now, it's good to see him sort of playing and contributing. Odegaard was in fantastic form again. Luton had injuries themselves, and so they were weakened as well. So from a spectacle point of view, it wasn't the most thrilling game, kind of a routine win. I think they were something like 30-1, or I read something ridiculous like that, Luton to win. So that sums up kind of how big of an underdog they were. But yeah, comfortable win really for Arsenal. And I think one thing that strikes me about them is I feel that they're quite different to City in the sense that they don't give up many transition chances. They don't give up many chances at all. They're very good at winning the second balls, winning duels, and I think that is a real factor that they've improved in. They seem very hard to kind of create chances against consistently. Whereas City, I always feel that they, as I mentioned before, they play a kind of high risk game where you can get at them at times, but then they still manage to pull out results. So I think Arsenal are very strong this season, and I think they're going to take some stopping, to be honest.
That's interesting because I still find Arsenal perhaps more interesting to watch, and that, they shouldn't be. Like, if City are sort of a bit more vulnerable, and I don't know if I'm just watching with this kind of, I don't think City are vulnerable, even when I'm watching vulnerability in front of me, I mean, it's all relative with these top three sides, that actually Arsenal are the least interesting, Barry, because they're the most solid. And what you want is teams that might concede.
Yeah, but I think we all in the back of our minds still have this feeling, nagging doubt that Arsenal things up. And like I had no concerns that they would lose this game last night, but there's still the worry that there's this inherent lack of backbone in Arsenal, even though it hasn't been there for quite some time. But I was worried for Luton last night. I thought they might get absolutely battered. And I'd say if you'd offered Rob Edwards 2-0 defeat before kickoff, he'd have taken it. And, Luton have given quite a few elite teams a good game this season, but they've also shipped a few hidings. This was just an absolutely routine win for Arsenal. And whereas before you might have been worried, it's Arsenal, they could mess this up. But and I think Arteta showed how confident he is that his team does have backbone, that he was able to make the five changes and still send out a team that ran out comfortable winners.
Yeah, I mean, look, Luton are sort of decimated. And if Luton are decimated, yes, then it's a problem. They had a guy on the bench who's in year 11 and three other teenagers. They had two sub-goalkeepers. On the pitch, they had a right-back at centre-back and a right-winger at right-back. And that right-winger who was at right-back, Onye Dinma, was meant to be on loan in League One and got injured, so came back and only got a squad number last week. So, you sort of sense, Robin, they're running out of puff a bit. I mean, they're still in touch, right? They are still definitely in touch. But, when they're missing Lokonga and Adebayo and, it's just, they need everybody, right?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly the phrase I would have said. They just seems like running out of steam a little bit, and the defeats and the tough games and not getting results. It looks like it's just starting to get on top of them a little bit. That's no win in 10 now. But as you say, they're still in touch. They kind of need to get that belief back. And it's the home games that could do it. So they've got Bournemouth, Brentford, Everton and Fulham those home games. So those feel like really key games. Right. So they can still do it, especially as there are still asterisks to come. I believe, you know, Everton might get more points deducted. I mean, it's not great for anyone, including Luton, that I'm sure they don't want to stay up just because some other teams got points deductions. Although they'll take it.
They won't give a shit, Robert.
I think they say out loud, this is not how we want to stay up, but inside they'll stay up any which way, right? Yeah, exactly. Was I the only person that found the sort of weird camera angle that TNT kept going? So they had the normal wide shot, and I don't know if something had gone wrong with it occasionally, but they're on this kind of weird, like, it was like a really enormous person had a Steadicam and was just running around.
It's like a computer game.
Yeah, it was like Striker on the Amiga, I think. But I don't know what you think, Baz.
No, you mentioned this in the WhatsApp. I didn't really notice until you mentioned it. And then I didn't really have an opinion on it one way or the other. Mm-hmm. So. Okay.
Jonathan, did you care? Or was this just me?
I definitely noticed it. It's kind of like a wide lens. It felt like FIFA kind of thing. But
yeah. It's quite FIFA-y.
I didn't really have an opinion on it. Like, it's kind of just there. Oh. I didn't really.
See, I don't play video games, so I don't really understand the reference.
No, neither do I anymore, you know. No, I know the reference is fine, but it's just I know how I want to watch football, which is a big wide shot, and occasionally I go close in, but don't be close in when there's actual football playing, because I want to see the football, you know. Yeah. I watched this game with my friend Matt, who is a Luton fan. That's why I got so much information on, you know, Luton's injury crisis, because I actually, you know, it's the most research I'd done on Luton this season, and his son Isaac and some other three other 11-year-olds around 11, Leo, Enzo, and Milo, right? And they kept referring to players as sweaty ballers, right? Now that's obviously important that we get the parlance that the youngsters are using, but my understanding was that they had kind of constructed this from gaming, but actually sweaty is now actually a positive thing. Like, to me, if you were a sweaty baller, it just sounds, you're quite sinister really, but like but apparently being sweaty these days is quite a good,
yeah, it means you're sick, Max.
You're
a sick baller. Yeah.
Right. Has anyone else heard sweat used in a sort of positive sense? I mean,
Jonathan, you're the, come on.
I'm afraid that 11-year-olds are not my...
No, it's going to be on you. Obviously, you know.
Not my target audience.
Producer Joel thought it meant you were trying too hard if you were sweaty. But maybe it's gone full circle now and it just shows you're really putting it in. Anyway, if there are anyone...
It sounds like one you need to look up in the Urban Dictionary.
Mm. Yes, yeah. Maybe they were just taking me for a ride, these chaps. But anyway, well done to all the sweaty ballers at the Emirates. There weren't any sweaty ballers at the G-Tech, were there, Robin? Brentford 0, Brighton 0. You got the big gig for Match of the Day last night.
I certainly did. I buzzed through afterwards and said, you could just tell Gary to say, listen, no one needs to see any of this. We got nothing. They did a really good job of editing it, got to say. They made it look a lot more exciting than it was.
Really?
My goodness. Yeah, no, it was not good. Not good. I think two teams, this was proper cliche cancelling each other out. Like, there was no mistakes from either side. Brighton had all of the ball. Brentford behind the ball. Brighton had a lot of shots from distance. And then when Brentford got in behind, Brighton recovered. And that was it. The highlights were guy dressed in full beekeeper's outfit. That was tremendous. With net as well. Like, he was going to catch some.
Well, I noticed, Robin, that the man dressed as a beekeeper was standing beside a woman who was dressed as a bee. And the camera cut to them, and you said, the G-Tech community stadium, not exactly a buzz so far. I think you should have been fired on the spot for that.
Yeah, you could have gone with Hive of Activity.
Nice.
Couldn't you as well?
Nice.
So many options there. Professionally, when you're watching a game that's terrible, Robin, obviously you've still got a job to do. Like, you know, halfway through, because if you're a fan, you just start talking to the person next to you about, you know,
going on your phone.
Yeah, their marriage or their next holiday or just, you know, something else. But you can't really do that in your position. Do you... Like, do you find your mind wandering, or are you just such an elite pro that commentating's quite a hard, it's quite an involved part of football broadcasting that you're just sort of, I guess, you in your moment?
No, I was on my phone. No, it's really hard. It's hard because it really was very, very dull. Yeah, as I said, it is funny watching De Zerbi though. He looked in physical pain every time they missed a chance. And there was a bit where he was wearing like a zip-up fleece and he disappeared into it. Well, that was quite good. As someone said to me, that's where you earn your money. I didn't really feel like I did, really. Because usually, yeah, in my because of my disposition, usually I drive home and I think, why? You should have said that. Why didn't you say that? Why did you do that? As Barry is brought up there. but, you know, yesterday I slept like a baby because nothing happened. Nothing happened. The only thing I would say is that's quite interesting is that off the pitch, you know, Brighton have posted this enormous profit and there's a lot of talk about De Zerbi, you know, not, you know, sort of angling for maybe a bit more investment in the playing squad or something. I do an Oxford United podcast and we have an ex player on, and he said when he once was a player and a club posted a profit, the players were furious. Like, why are you paying us more? So it's just, yeah, it's interesting because it's very eye catching, isn't it? Because it's very rare, especially for a Premier League team. It's 122.8 million. I mean, it's all player sales for Brighton.
And that doesn't include the 115 million they got from Moyes Caicedo. So that hasn't. So it's 122 million and. Plus 115.
How great when they check their balance and it says pending plus 115 million. That's not really what you get, is it? You go pending, going, ah, oh, shit, that's coming out. That's got to come out. I can't. That balance isn't what my balance is. I mean, the question for De Zerbi, and he's in quite a good position, like any young sort of up-and-coming manager, if that's the right way to describe him, Jonathan, is that there are so many jobs going this summer that, like, he might end up getting a better job than perhaps he would normally expect to get on the next step of his career trajectory.
There's a lot of jobs. I don't know where he might want to go next. He definitely regularly talks about wanting more ambition at the club. So I think he mentioned in his press conference last night that he doesn't want to create a polemic, but he just wants to do the best for the club, which involves wanting more investment and that kind of thing. And I think he has created a polemic there because it does.
I think you're absolutely right.
It does seem to be a bit of tension in the way that he continuously talks about it. I mean, you could look at it from two ways. You know, maybe he just thinks that they can elevate their level, and that there's nothing wrong with that, I suppose, from some point of view. But I don't know if it does come across as maybe giving a little bit of a feeling that maybe he might be more satisfied elsewhere, somewhere with a bigger budget. I think he could well deserve a. I'm hesitant to say a bigger job because that's a bit unfair on Brighton.
I mean, no, it's the literal reality of bigger clubs, right? I mean, that is true. We all know it.
Yeah, potentially. But has he done enough to get sort of a Liverpool job or sort of Bayern Munich? I'm not entirely sure. But there are going to be a lot of jobs available. So, yeah, he's got options.
He's been extremely non-committal about his future. And I'm pretty sure it was Paul Barber, the Brighton's chief exec, I heard on TalkSport yesterday. I missed the start, but I'm pretty sure it was him. He was being interviewed and he didn't seem hugely confident that De Zerbi would stay. But the thing is, Tony Bloom, the owner of Brighton, he's quite a, you know, very single-minded, successful, obviously, individual. Very good poker player. That's where he made his money first. And if you're going to get in a game of poker with Tony Bloom, you know, I could see De Zerbi talk himself out of a job at Brighton and then possibly get sacked. That I'm going to put that out there as a long shot. But yeah, I think De Zerbi might get a bit too clever, and Tony Bloom would be well able for him, I'd say.
I'm sure they have a plan, don't they? They always have who's next after De Zerbi. They seem to always have someone in mind because he was brought in so quickly after Graham Potter left.
Tonight, Liverpool, Sheffield United, and Chelsea, Manchester United. So we presume Liverpool will win that game. I mean, Chelsea, Manchester United, it's hard, Jonathan. I mean, can you remember a Chelsea Man U game with less at stake? and probably the last time they played, I guess. But also a more impossible to call Chelsea-Manchester United game. I mean, literally no idea what either of these sides will do.
I'm not sure if I agree with you there, Max. I think there is quite a lot of stake still. And I think Erik ten Hag needs to keep his job, for one. And I think he's on an extended job interview between now and the end of the season. I know what you mean in terms of European football and titles. And obviously those days are gone for both those teams at this moment in time. But I think even Pochettino, I think there's a sort of sense that, you know, Chelsea are in 12th place, which is, it just baffles me how bad they are and how accepted it is that all that investment, it's almost been normalised how terrible they've been for the last 2 years, no matter what they've tried. So I still feel like there's things to play for, but I get what you mean. And in terms of predicting it, I think the first game they played, the Old Trafford game, it was an entertaining match, but it was, I thought, from a spectacle, in terms of quality, I thought it was really poor. Both sides, it was like a basketball match, sort of end to end, because both sides don't know how to defend, can't compete in transitions. So it, from that point of view, it was fun to watch, but from the point of view of quality, it was quite poor. So I think I couldn't predict it, but I suppose Manchester United go into it with more to play for and so therefore need to win. But whether they will or not, I'm not sure, Max.
Well, we'll cover those games on Monday if they are fascinating. If not, we'll have forgotten about them. But the weekend's Premier League fixture list, I mean, like Manchester United-Liverpool is the standout fixture, Barry. And if we look at the run-ins of Liverpool, Arsenal and City, this game for Liverpool, it feels to me like, in terms of sort of form goes out of the window games for Liverpool, it's this one and Everton away that you sort of feel might decide if they get every point from their remaining games, Liverpool.
I don't think Everton away is going to be any problem whatsoever for Liverpool.
Fair enough.
I really don't. This one's weird. Obviously, Manchester, both sides have to play tonight. You presume Liverpool will swat Sheffield United aside like yourself. I haven't a clue what's going to happen at Stamford Bridge. Between Chelsea and Manchester United, probably a draw, because it's just so hard to call that one. If Manchester United, like, the performance they put in against Brentford at the weekend was shocking. It was diabolical, really, really, really bad. If they play Ayton like that, Liverpool will hammer them. But then Manchester United beat them last time in the Cup, didn't they? No one saw that one coming. So, but I just, oh God, yeah, that performance against Brentford was, if it was just a one-off anomaly, you know, you'd go, ah, fair enough, a collective bad day at the office. But Manchester United have played so badly so often this season, I think Liverpool will beat them.
No, they should do. That's what you imagine. Liverpool have also got to play Villa and Spurs in a row. Like, so that's quite a tricky bit.
I'd say they're a lot tougher propositions than Everton,
yeah,
Liverpool.
I think so. But their form in the window, aren't they? Their form in the window games, or in the room games, is a form out, you know, sort of the ones that wouldn't be, you know, Liverpool playing Man United, I think, is different for maybe City, Man United and Arsenal. They're not also quite big, but it feels slightly different. Everton, certainly. Arsenal go to Brighton, Robin. And looking at their run-in, they've got this week where they play Chelsea at home and Spurs away, which sort of feels like the decisive bit for them. I'm sort of with you. They could win every game and still not win the league, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think it. Well, it depends what the others do, obviously. But it's kind of in Liverpool's hands. But I think you said on the last pod, Max, there's still a lot of games to be played. Obviously, they're all still in Europe as well, so that could play a factor. But yeah, I think that the Man United game this weekend, I think Liverpool will be extra motivated because of the manner in which they lost that FA Cup game, and you know that would have really hurt. So. Yeah, and as Barry mentioned, I mean, my God, it was that Brentford game was an absolute robbery, even though they only got a point from it. So it's Liverpool just look like, I think, a bit like City, as Jonathan said. They do give up chances, they do, so they're quite fun to watch, but they just seem to know how to get over the line. They're on that roll now, and I can't really see them dropping points. Although, as you say, like Spurs definitely give them a game, and Villa, of course. So those are the ones that could be potential stumbling blocks. But even then, Spurs and Villa aren't quite in the same their best form as they were in the reverse fixtures, I'd say. And also Spurs, yeah that's true. That's still yeah, that the whole narrative around that's going to be the VAR cock up, isn't it, from the last one?
Yeah, totally. Oh yeah, who's going to be on VAR for Liverpool Spurs?
That's going to be a big headline.
They should get the same team back together. That's what they should do, the BGMOL. Meanwhile, for City, Jonathan, they go to Palace. And obviously they've got Real Madrid in Europe. They're still in the FA Cup as well. But if you listen, if I list their league games, I can't see where they're dropping a point. Palace away, Luton at home, Brighton away, Forest away, Wolves at home, Fulham away, West Ham at home. Like, that running for Man City is winning every game, isn't it?
Did they drop points against Forest last season away? I might be wrong.
I did write that. That is the only, because Forest will be fighting and the City ground can be quite, you know, noisy. But even still, if that's your hardest game left, Forest away, you're in a good spot, right?
Brighton can be awkward, can't they?
City always seem to defy me, because I always feel like they've got a sort of a game where they'll throw it in a sense, but they never sort of do. They're so open, and they I feel like maybe in the Champions League someone might give them a bit of a beating. But I've said this before about Pep's teams, and the high risk game he plays always pays off. So yeah, they have a decent running, but I think the Spurs Arsenal game is as close to a title decider as it's not quite a title decider, but I think that's a huge game. I really think that is going to be maybe one of the best games we have left of the season. I think that's going to be a fantastic match. Spurs stop Arsenal winning the title? Essentially, that's going to be brilliant.
Oh, feels really painful when you put it like that. I sort of think intellectually, I don't mind Arsenal winning the league, but now you've said it like that.
I mean, you say, Max, that on the face of it, you would expect City to win all those games, but as John said, they do have a rick in them. Palace beat them that time with that Andros Townsend unbelievable strike. They lost home and away to Brentford last season. Who the hell would have predicted that?
Yeah, true. Palace held them at the Etihad, didn't they, this year, actually?
Okay, right. I don't remember, but I'll take your word for it.
Well, I'm pretty sure of it. At the bottom, Everton-Burnley is fun, Barry, isn't it? You know, any Sean Dyche derby is big.
Yeah, I don't think it'll be fun somehow. I suspect, I hope Robin hasn't got this one as well. No, that'd be...
No, I would have loved it, though. I mean, that's two irate managers. Absolutely furious. That could be fun.
Oh, yeah, I mean, yeah, the outcome will be fun. It won't be fun for one or both of them. I mean, I suppose a point's more used to Everton than Burnley, but... Everton have to win a game at some point. I mean, what is it now? 14 games without a win?
Yeah, 13, I think.
13. Yeah. They have to win a game at some point. But Burnley have certainly improved in recent games and probably should have got... They could have beaten Chelsea. They had... Who's it? Someone hit the bar or hit
Jay
the
Rodriguez.
Post. Jay Rodriguez hit the post. I was about to say Ashley Barnes again. I've now... I've got the Fabianski areolas with Jay Rodriguez and Ashley Barnes. So anyway, I don't know what's going on in my head. But yeah, Burnley on form, you would think, should win. Will they? Don't know.
Mm. Luton host Bournemouth. That is a winnable game. And Forest go to Tottenham, which... should be less winnable, but you never know, I guess. All right, that'll do for part two. I'll do any other business in part three.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Support comes from ServiceNow, the AI platform for business transformation. You've heard the hype around AI. The truth is, AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow is the platform that puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/AI for people to learn more.
Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. The Lionesses play Sweden tomorrow night and Ireland on Tuesday. Are you doing those, Robin?
It's ITV.
Oh, is it? Yeah. Okay, boom. qualifiers for Euro 2025. And England also got France in their group.
Yeah. So
what shape are Serena Wiegmann's side in?
Yeah, they're in pretty good shape. I mean, that is a very, very, very tough qualifying group. But England should win. They had a very good last camp where they were scoring lots of goals. Got some new, exciting new players who have come into form. Jess Park, who's been brilliant for Manchester City, especially in recent weeks. Grace Clinton, who's on loan at Spurs. Be interesting to see if she gets more minutes in the midfield. Looking in good shape. You know my thoughts on Serena Wiegmann, Max. You know, mm-hmm. She is queen and she will lead us. She will lead us once again to the defending the Euros. I'm absolutely certain of it.
Can I ask you, Robin, on the subject of women's football, what you made of the Emma Hayes, Jonas Eidevall spat the other day? I'm a massive Emma Hayes fan. She's in my top five people I'd like to go on the piss with. But I thought she was a bit out of order there, ungracious. Would you agree? Or?
Yeah, can I read the quotes, actually? Because if you haven't followed it, it was the League Cup final. Arsenal beat Chelsea with a late goal. There was a bit of a moment over a Chelsea wanted to take a quick throw-in and Jonas Eidevall saying, hang on, we agreed to only use one football, not a million footballs. And afterwards, he then went to shake Emma Hayes' hand and she sort of shoved him. And Emma Hayes said, I am not down for male aggression on the touchline. I told him this. There's a way to conduct yourself. He got a yellow card and he should have been sent off. Interestingly, the yellow card was about his celebration. It wasn't about the moment that she's kind of suggesting it was there. I get he's a winner, but his behaviour is unacceptable. The way he fronted up to Erin was unacceptable. We should not blow it up. I'm sure when he is calm, we can have a conversation. Also, the camera doesn't seem to suggest that he does front up to Erin Cuthbert. It's not the first time he's been told it should not be a massive story. Eidevall said he did not feel comfortable with the label. There's a way you behave in the technical area, he said. You need to be a good winner and a good loser. I'm happy with the way I conduct myself. Others need to look themselves in the mirror. The Guardian Women's Football Weekly covered this really well, Robin.
They did,
What I thought was really interesting was that phrase male aggression is very pointed. And I'm not somebody who follows the women's game religiously. And I'm also really conscious that I'm a man talking about male aggression in the women's game. And so I wanted to listen to, what Susie thought and other people on that pod and what you thought, because it is such a, you've got to, that language really matters, doesn't it? And you have to be, because it's such an issue and there is that power dynamic in women's football, there's a lot of men in women's football. So I'm interested to know where you stand on it.
Oh, well, I think you're right. Susie Rack basically covered it really well and she's written about it as well. I'm reluctant to, because we don't really know what happened, for absolute 100% sure. Jonas Eidevall has also been accused previously of being a bully on the touchline by the Manchester City coach. He also had a bit of a set to with a Manchester United player last season. So this is in mitigation for what Emma Hayes said. But the evidence that we have is that what she said isn't really was reality. And I agree that saying male aggression is extremely loaded and labelling him with that, not just unfair, it's totally out of order. She's not stupid and I don't think it was in the heat of the moment. She knows what she said. And yeah, no, I agree, Barry. I have huge admiration for Emma Hayes. She's inspirational, a role model, what she's had to put up with and the way she's conducted herself. But that was really, really unfair of her. As I say, I don't want to kind of call her a liar or anything because I just don't really know what goes on. Just with the evidence that we have, it didn't seem like that was very fair on him. And it was interesting, actually, because it's been discussed everywhere. It was discussed when I was in the press room at Brentford yesterday. So it's been quite the story. It'll be interesting to see when she's asked about it again. Unfortunately, it's an international break now for the women, so it'll be a while. So if she does sort of row back on it, that will be interesting. But yeah, it's it, as you said, words matter. And if she'd just said aggression, I think we'd be like, well, yeah, maybe he was a bit too aggressive on the touchline. But male aggression, as you said, that's the kind of extremely loaded phrase. And yeah, I think, yeah, as I say, it would be interesting to see what she says. I know Jonas quite well because we worked together at the World Cup and the last Euros, and he's always been very, you know, generous, kind, great person to be around. So yeah, I think we've got to basically wait and see what she says when she's next asked about it.
Jonathan, you've been to Sweden for the opening weekend of the Allsvenskan. Did you have a nice time, and should we all be watching the Swedish league more with even more attention than we already do?
I had a fantastic time, thank you, Max. Yeah, I just got back yesterday, so I had a great time. I love it there. It's a nice country. And in terms of should you be watching the Swedish or Allsvenskan, you definitely should. I take an interest anyway in leagues that are outside the traditional leagues. So things like non-league and Swedish football appeal to me more and more these days. But I also think that they appeal to more other people as well. I think there's anecdotal evidence to suggest that non-league, for example, is getting more and more popular. Attendances are massively up these days. You're getting sort of 3,000-4,000 in the National League South. Even below, there's, you know, I think the 8th and 9th tiers are getting sort of 1,000 plus people at games now regularly. And that's all around, not just the bigger clubs. And the benefit of the Swedish Allsvenskan is there's no VAR. So it's one of the few remaining European leagues where there is absolutely no VAR to wait around for. And to me, I enjoy it much more. So that's one perspective on it. I think you were going to come in there with maybe a question.
No. I was just listening along there. Who's doing well? I mean, it's just started. Who should I adopt?
It's obviously a lower quality league. So if you want the best players, you're not going to see the best players. From a fan culture point of view, though, it's great. I was at IFK Gothenburg against Djurgården, who are two of the biggest teams. If you have a chance to see the IFK sort of TIFO when the fans come out and the song they play, it's really one of the best anthems. It's one of the most underrated anthems in world football. The anthem at IFK Gothenburg is really, really good. It matches the Bundesliga and other sort of top leagues for kind of atmosphere in that sense. Fan culture in Swedish football is great from that point of view.
Is it Ace of Base? Is it all that she wants? Is that the...
No, it's not. But trust me, it's really good. I'll send you a link.
I thought ABBA, and I thought I'd go better than ABBA. I thought I'd go. It's I Saw the Sign by Ace of Base. That's what it is. No, but I think that's interesting. There is a kind of, I mean, I don't know if it's just because there's just more content, right? So maybe lots of people always liked these leagues, but we didn't ever see it. But perhaps there is, you know, we were talking previously about, you know, the sort of season ticket prices in the Premier League. And look, we are, I don't know if we're guilty of being very Premier League focused. That's what we are, right, as a podcast. But, you know, it's once you know a league and the stories, that's what I always found about supporting a lower league team in the, you know, EFL, is actually once you know who the players are, there's something nicer. Actually, you know, sort of 20 years, 30 years ago, you know, there were players that were slightly overweight and who smoked, and players who could only kick it out of the stand. And actually all those things, actually quite fun. And that, you know, that lower quality doesn't necessarily mean lower entertainment.
Well, my personal interest in it is more about, you know, finding undervalued talent. And I just like sort of the things that are a little bit outside the norm maybe. But that's not to say there isn't talent, because one of the best players in the Premier League at the moment is Alexander Isak. And he came from AIK, which is in the Swedish Allsvenskan, obviously. If you look at QPR, their manager at the moment, Marty Cifuentes, was at Hammarby in Sweden last season. And I think, you know, Barry just mentioned about Brighton and maybe looking to the poker game that might happen with the Zerbi. I will give you, I would say with some confidence that if they do get rid of the Zerbi, they will be looking at a manager in Sweden called Henrik Rydström at Malmo, who is a very, very good manager, and I think he will be linked with English clubs in the future. So it's not only the fact that it's maybe the fan experience and no VAR and that kind of side of it is fun. I think there's also a lot of talent in these leagues, and I think, yeah, that's another element of it that is quite interesting. Obviously, one of the players I saw was Lucas Bergvall, who's Tottenham have just signed. He played in the game, one of the games I went to see, so and he was outstanding. So yeah, there's plenty of talent there, as well as it, you know, it might not be Premier League level talent, but there's a lot of gems there that you can find and watch as well. So that's fun to do as well.
On the selfie that you took with Bob yesterday, Barry, or the day before yesterday, where you said you had just got out of bed and you sort of had red wine stains over your face and sort of dishevelled. Dickensian look you had on your
Joggy bottoms and a hoodie on.
Bob got in touch to say hi, Barry, to be fair.
Oh, did he?
He said, I'm not sure who looked worse. He says, great to meet you, made my day. Sad, sorry not to make the beer next time. Cheers, Bob. I have seen the photo and I can comfortably say that you look worse. But the way you phrased it, I was expecting a lot worse. Okay, actually, right. you looked, I mean, I don't know where I set the bar, but you looked pretty presentable to me.
Yeah, well, I was half asleep, as I said, because I was working all weekend and I Tuesday off. I had quite a few drinks on Monday night, and I was far from my best.
No. Andy, and you'll have to help me with this, Barry. T-A-D-H-G, Tard?
Tig.
Andy and Tig have been in touch. Dear Max, Barry, producer Joel, and panellists. Myself, Tig, and Stephen are long-time listeners of the pod, attendees of the live shows in Dublin. You may recall Tig from the Monday live show in Dublin last November. He was the kind gentleman who offered you his piss during your Bear Grylls Ray Mears skit. Those who don't come to the live show will go, what on earth is... what's that? What's this sort of performance? Anyway, come to the next one. It was a riotous success. Stephen is getting married in the coming weeks, and nothing in the world would give him more joy. Not his upcoming marriage, nor even the prospect of Liverpool winning the league this year with a Klopp mic drop exit, than for Barry to wish him and... oh, hang on a second. C-A-O-I-M-H-E.
Quiver.
Tig and Stephen is marrying Quiver. Tig is not marrying Quiver. That would be really awkward now. Anyway, Quiver. Barry to wish Stephen and Quiver well for the future in the way that only he can. Love listening to the pod, Andy and Tig. So there you go, Barry. If you could wish Stephen and Quiver all the best.
I wish Stephen and Quiver all the best. Was it Stephen who offered us his piss?
No, Tig. And he says, P.S. Tig's offer still stands. Should you ever need some extra piss? We're okay right now.
Well, if Stephen and Quiver, I don't know, when the spark goes out of the relationship and their marriage is on the brink, maybe they should invite...
No, I don't see where this is. This is not a water sports-based podcast, Barry.
Okay, right. Well, maybe they shouldn't invite Andy or Ty to join in and spice things up with some water sports. But anyway, I hope they have a lovely day, and I wish them every happiness.
Yes, I'd like to apologise to my friend Matt, the Luton fan. So his son Isaac doesn't listen to this podcast, listens to a rival podcast, and they say the thing that Matt doesn't like about that one is it's a bit sweary. So if they have got to the end and now we're discussing this sort of thing, then there's an interesting conversation in the car. I believe Matt's wife Rachel, who I was also at school with, would be very disappointed in me, but you know, my apologies to all of you. What Barry suggests is not what I suggest. Different people. Anyway, that'll do for today. Thank you, Robin.
Thanks, Max.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Max.
And thank you, Barry.
Thanks.
Football Weekly is produced by Joel Grove. Give him a wave if you're watching the Brighton Marathon, because he's running that on Sunday. Ooh. Aiming for 3 hours 15. It's utterly ludicrous. Good luck to you, Joel.
Hold on now. What's his name?
Wilson Kipketer?
Producer of... No. The Ellis James and John Robbins podcast.
Dave Martin. Is it still Dave?
Producer Dave Masterman. Yeah. He's run a sub 3 hour marathon, so wow. I expect Joel to up his game and beat producer Dave.
I was going to say, if you can't beat 3 hours, we want a new producer.
Jobs on the line.
Yeah, exactly. Jobs on the line.
Hanging by a thread.
Absolutely right. Next kilometer 17. Time 5 minutes and 8 seconds. Not good enough. Step on it. Our executive producer, who is not running the Brighton Marathon, is Max Sanders.
This is The Guardian.